Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers, but that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP-certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science-first supplementation. After adding ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Ready?
Yep.
Guys, you know what time it is. This is my favorite tradition. Fingal Ferguson's here for the Christmas special, Full Blast Podcast. I'm Jeff Fader, and stop talking about it because you know. Let's take care of a little business, and we're going to have some fun. But first things first, I want to thank my friends at Broadbeck Ironworks, makers of the 2x72 grinder, and more. Go to broadbeckironworks.com, put in the promo code KNIFETALK10. You get 10% off all their great grinders, all the attachments, all the power hammer stuff, all that stuff. Many thanks for the years of support from my friends at Broadbeck Ironworks. I use Broadbeck Ironworks. Ryan's building them in Ohio, I believe, and he's doing a great job, and we're huge supporters of my man, Ryan Broadbeck of Broadbeck Ironworks. We're also big supporters of my friends at Evenheat, manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com, get that tap control, get that solid state drive. Don't stop. I mean, if you got to get it hard, stop playing, get it Evenheat. You know what I mean? Many thanks to Spence and the family, lovely family in Michigan. I've known them for many years, and I couldn't do this business, Fader Knives, without my Evenheat. So if I can't, you can't. So that's number two. Many thanks to my friends at Maritime Knife Supply. Lawrence Lake now sent me a message. He's sitting in Cozumel, scuba diving Cozumel, much deserved. He's the man, and he's got all your belts, abrasives, steels, kilns, forges, presses, heat treating ovens, all that stuff. He's in Canada. If you're in Canada and you need a metalworking supplies, a.k.a. knife making supplies and stuff like that, you got to go to Maritime Knife Supply. He got that Norton Razor Star and the Norton Blazes. So stop playing. That's number one, number two, number three. Many thanks to Lawrence. He is incredibly supportive of the maker community, and I'm incredibly supportive of him. I hope you're having a good time down in Cozumel, my boy. You deserve it. And make sure you hit Isla Mujeres. I like East Loma Harris better than Cozumel. That's just me. Listen to me. Oh, look at me. Unbelievable. What a piece of you-know-what. Many thanks to my friends at Baker Forge, BakerForge.com, Baker Forge and Tool on Instagram for all your exotic steels, copper my, tiger my, bronze my, all them stuff. And not to mention, they'll teach you how to use it. You get that core right in the middle, and then they'll teach you how to heat treat it, and then they'll teach you how to etch it. And when before you etch it, you got to use their new degreaser, the Grime Reaper. And once the Grime Reaper's done, then you got to use them Gator Piss. And they got three different types. Gator Piss OG. I love Gator Piss OG. Gator Piss Max for the stainless Damascus. And Gator Piss Heavy for that deep dark you know what. So many thanks to my friend Coy and the boys are doing a great job. I get a lot of messages from Coy and the boys. They're fooling around and they're having a great time. And they're bigger and better things for them in 2026. I am sure of it. You can also get some Gator Piss over my boys over at Texas Ferry Supply. Evan and Texas Ferry Supply has been supporting this podcast and Knife Talk for a long time. We're huge fans of Texas Ferry Supply. If you're a blacksmith, bladesmith, however you identify, you can get all the stuff there. And you can get 10% off when you put in the promo code KnifeTalk10. Oh, by the way, you can get 10% off at Baker Forge. You just put in the promo code FullBlast, and you get 10%. But all the show notes have all the links and all the discounts and all that stuff. Once in a while, I get a message from the big man. That's Nick Anger, and he'll ask me what the promo code is, and I'll tell him, bro, you got to listen to the show, and then you got to go to the show notes. So Texas Ferry Supply is 10% off with KnifeTalk10. Total Boat, my buddy's a Total Boat. I love that Total Boat. I'm making some handle hybrid material with Total Boat. I'm using the Fathom Thick Set. I use the Fathom Thick Set. I use a two-part epoxy. I use the UV Cure. I use the hell out of the CA glue. I'm all in on that CA glue. And I go to totalboat.com/fullblast, and I'm going to get some discount and street cred from me. You're getting the discount. I'm getting the street cred. So blah, 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 I'm with them. I'm a huge fan out in Rhode Island. Now, I'm using it all. I only use the two-part. I only use the Total Boat products. I don't use anybody else. So many thanks to Total Boat for everything. Kristen, Merry Christmas. Hope you're well. Leah, Merry Christmas. Hope you're well. Cheryl. Merry Christmas to you too, Cheryl. And Mark. I can't forget Mark. All the people at Total Boat, you're the best. Many thanks to my friends at Jill Hansen & Sons. Just got a Christmas package from Greg Hansen. It's g.l.underscore Hansen & Sons on Instagram, and then gcarter.bigcartel.com. He sent me some like candy cane scales and stuff like that. And I'm going to have to figure out how to use them. They look great. And you can use their scales too. You can get the Mahi Mahi, Radiorm G Carta, the Pheasant, the Hoopla, the Colorama, all that beautiful cross-cut G Carta, which is really amazing. It's a unique composite of fabrics and epoxies mixed under pressure with heat. Stuff is awesome. So definitely go to gcarta.bigcartel.com. And stop playing, period. That's it. Stop playing. Get yourself some of the stuff that your customers are asking for. When your customers start asking for it, then you better get on the program. You might be too late. You're never too late with G Carta. You know what I mean? I know my boy Finkel's using that G Carta. I saw him. He was making that Pheasant, but we'll talk about that later.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah. I want to thank my friends at Tormek. Tormek celebrating 50 years of being in business with the Black TA sharpening system. Tormek's the greatest. They sent me a nice card, and I become very good friends with the people at Tormek because they're good people, and they stand behind their products, and Tormek has changed the way I make knives. I make better knives now, and it's because I'm using the Tormek. So get yourself involved with Tormek. Get yourself that. And if you're thinking, what should I get with the Tormek? Get the axe jig. That's pretty slick. You can get the scissor jig, which I love. I'm sharpening every scissor. I'm cutting toilet paper. I got scissors all over the place, and I'm just using it for anything because they're sharp as hell.
Jiggity, jiggity, jiggity.
That's it. Jiggity, jiggity, jiggity. I'm with you. So get yourself that Tormek and stop playing. Now you're in Australia and you're saying to yourself, I want to get all this stuff, but I'd rather have to learn how to use it first. Why don't you go to Nordic Edge, Nordic Edge, Nordic underscore Edge on Instagram, nordicedge.com.au. They not only supply great products in Australia, like the file guide. Their file guide's the best, by the way. But they also teach classes, blacksmithing, leatherworking, spoon carving, all that stuff, leatherworking, all that, blacksmithing, bladesmithing, I said it all. And then you can start to figure out if you're going to get it, you need to buy it. And they got the best stuff and the best stuff around, and they have the best customer service around, and they have the best dudes around. And Mert Tansu's involved. That's great. That's good enough for me. Jamie Bishop, my guy, is all in, and I'm all in with them. Bjorn, too. So definitely get involved with them, nordicedge.com.au. And last but certainly not least, I want to thank my friends at Phoenix Abrasives for getting people into the Louvre for free. You know, they're using that. I mean, they're the guys who are making the discs that get the boy in the Louvre. I'm just kidding, obviously, but I wish it were the case. If you are looking for belts, abrasives, if you're looking for metal fabrication stuff, you're looking for discs, grinding discs for glass fabrication, pardon me, floor sanding, all that stuff, discs, flap discs, cutting wheels. You got to go to Phoenix Abrasives and put in the promo code FB10 at checkout, and you get 10% off. So definitely 100%. Many thanks to my sponsors all year long. Guys have been behind me, and I am behind you. And I've been using the products from my sponsors, and I've been very, very helpful. It's been very, very helpful to me, and I hope it's very, very helpful to you. So many thanks. This is the last show of the year. I want to thank everybody, all the sponsors, all the listeners, and everything like that. And I want to thank my boy. My boy is here, Finkel Ferguson. You all know who he is. He's the king of Ireland. I mean, he's the king of all. You know, you are. You're the king of all media of Ireland. I mean, you're making kick-ass knives for a long time. You're making beautiful cured meats and cheeses. You're a film guy. You are a king of all media of Ireland. As far
I'm just a stubborn guy who's been doing it for a long time. That's all.
You've been doing a great job. And I don't know. Here's what I don't understand. How come you always look so? You know, I've known you now, 10 years or something like that. You still look young. What's going on? What's your secret?
I'm only putting out the photographs that look good.
Get out of here. You look like a young, you got a smile, you got a twinkle in your eye. I got to meet you in Brooklyn, which was one of the highlights of the year for me. You had a short film released and you came to Brooklyn and you called me up and you said, are you going to make it? I'm like, you're goddamn right.
No, I'm glad we did that. Yeah, it was brilliant. Actually, fantastic venue. And actually, I'm glad to say that that's now that's live. It's actually out there in the world. So what I might just do is I'll send you on the link. It's in my bio and all those sort of things. It's Stripe. So do you know on your website when you're sort of buying and selling, you can sort of have the Stripe checkout and you can put the credit card payments through it. So, you know, famous American company. That's actually a couple of Irish guys who started it from Limerick.
Really?
So, yeah. So Ireland, big up Ireland. But what happened is that the Stripe had this wonderful crew that kind of were behind that. But rather than going on about it, I think just go out there and watch it. It's a 20-minute long, wonderful thing done by the powerhouse that is Stripe. And it was great fun to be part of it. So I'll send you on a link.
I'm going to link it in the bio of this show. You sent it to me tonight. Yeah. I got to send this all to Craig tonight. So send it. We're gonna. If you want to watch the show, I watched it. We watched. Here's the funniest part about that short film festival.
Yeah.
Thank God yours was the first. I'm telling you why. So we
should have got the hell out of there. We should have got the hell out of there.
My daughter and I came down. She was excited. She was in town for a little bit, and we came down. We got to meet Fingal, and then we got to meet Garrett Oliver, and all these really awesome guys. And then what happened was, we had a little couple drinks, had a little great food. We went, walked down the street in Greenpoint to this theater, and we're sitting down, and I don't know how many films there were.
There was quite a few, actually. Yeah, I didn't know what to expect either. So, I mean, the thing was I thought, was it just ours? Was there going to be two or three? I mean, to be honest, was there three or four?
Dude, I'm not sure. Here's the hilarious part. So yours was on first, and I'm thinking to myself, how can I duck out of this afterwards?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, how can I duck out of this? So we watched yours. It was amazing. And one of the things that's amazing about the short film is I feel as though, and I said this to you before, when they came, because, I mean, if you don't know Fingal, you wouldn't really know how to. I feel as though they curated the film, the filming and the documentary around your particular energy. Your energy is frenetic. It's exciting. It's happy. It's charismatic. It's like go go go. It's a little ADHD. And I feel as though, and that's with all due respect.
I know. I love it. Yeah.
But the film, because I know you, and I'm thinking to myself, at what point did these people figure out how to like capture him? Not only in the documentary, but the way they filmed it too.
I think they were around for a couple of days, and I think they probably got to know me at that stage, and it wasn't as fast a process of sort of having to get it in the can and get it out. So I think they actually put their time to it, and the director and the producers and the wonderful people, they all, I think they were discovering what they wanted to do themselves. There's another gentleman from New York who's actually a perfumier, and that's the other Stripe movie. This is part of this whole Tacit series, and I think the next step is to kind of see if a TV company will take it on. So I was the guinea pig, I suppose, the trial. So while they're trying to discover their formula, they had time to think about it, and I suppose maybe that was the magical time to be there, because there was that lovely energy. Do you know when you start off doing something, you're all fucking, let's get up and go, let's try everything and see what works, let's throw the shit at the wall and see what sticks. And so I was there for happily, you know, I've seen that, because I've had a lot of filming happen. I mean, like, look, I'm the, you know, multi-generational food. No.
You're the multi-generational talent of Ireland.
Well, what I'm kind of getting at is that I've seen people come to film us, and I've seen people who just have no fucking energy left doing what they have to do to get it done, to get out the door. And I've seen people come to who are really, like, they're young, they're youthful. This is the beginning of a project. And I'm always excited by that, because what happens is that you know, like anything, you see the same shit every day, you know, it gets old and you get bored when you're watching it. You know, you need the little twists and everything else. Like, do you remember every photograph for every magazine was that sort of wanky photograph of some guy holding a scissors at the launch of a new supermarket. You know, it was always that stand still and pose, make the same face. You know, like it's sort of people who are willing to be brave and try something new is kind of fun. It's like what we're trying to do with knives. I want to find that energy with somebody who's doing that with film or with their.
It's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, because that's that. But if you love what you do, you know, it's like you're excited. Like, look, we get inspiration all around us from nature, from Instagram, from everything that kind of inspires us to do what we do. And I think that's what you'd probably want to expect. What's the next thing? What's the evolution? How are things changing? What are the tools that are changing? What's the materials? You know, so I suppose in that way, it is kind of fun. And do you know what I've discovered is I think, because I've probably been making knives for about 15 years, I remember sort of Instagram starting, you know, all these things. So I suppose you do see, you know, you've seen the boring shit. You've seen the early days. So I suppose the funny thing is I've kind of found myself now, I'm not even taking photographs. I don't go into my pocket like an influencer and sort of snap everything and try and do things. I've almost probably started to rebel, and you're just kind of waiting for the perfect moment. One good click, you know, and find a nice one, but don't be the wanker with the camera in other people's faces, you know, and you know, like that's the thing. Like make the timing right, get it over with, and just be present is probably more important to me now, if you know what I mean.
Well, here's just to finish the story. So your film, in the film festival, yours come up first, and I was like, this is great. And then and I'm like, well, I can't just duck out as soon as, you know, Fringles is over. That's like, that's, you know, we'll just hang out a little bit. I'm looking at the clock, seeing
I would have joined you. I would have done it.
I know. Well, so the next one was really good. The next movie, yours was great. And then the next movie was about a guy who makes hats. Yeah. And that was really cool. And that was really very a Brooklyn story. And it was a really awesome. It was awesome. And then
there was a roller skate. Wasn't there a rollerblade guy?
I didn't see a rollerblade guy. But no, the roller skate.
Oh, you were out before that. Yeah.
The next one was about these very, very down and out people in Michigan or Chicago who are like saving dogs on the street. And that was like, the people seemed like they were on, like they were like, you know, one step, you know, one foot in the grave, the other foot in the banana peel. And then it was like about like, they look fucking, it was like, it was pretty
but
fucking
they had big rude. Hearts. They had big hearts. And that's what kind of came across. And there was a horse person and stuff like that.
Movie, so that one was just like, oh, Jesus Christ, I don't know if I can handle much more of this. Mm-hmm. And then the next one was about this guy who tries to tame the horse. Mm-hmm. And they finally tame the horse, and the goddamn horse dies. And I turn to Lila, and I'm like, I can't do it. It's going to go downhill from here. I
mean, old Buck Beauty's fucked.
Yeah. It was, I mean, spoiler alert. It was just Lila was just like, oh my God, how much more of this do we have to take? And I'm like, I don't know. But your mother, I said, if your mother had been here, she'd have left. She'd have left right after the hat guy.
She'd be out the fucking door.
God. I was just like, I love you, dude, but I can't handle this.
I can imagine you and me doing commando roles, like kind of like on the haunches, like army guys kind of sneaking away on our haunches.
That was the best part. It was just It was systematically getting more depressing, and I was just like, I'm going to kill myself at the end of this goddamn film festival if I any more dead animals. There's dead dogs, dead horses, and all this shit. And I'm like, oh my God.
I know. Jeez. But that's the thing, because I suppose in the end, it wasn't a premiere. It was actually a film festival that we were at, and I suppose we had to remember that.
Yeah, it was a film festival.
Yeah. But look, that's it. Look, it's all
you
it's
did
all
a
good.
Great job. I tell you what, once again, I was amazed. I felt as though there was a decision, even maybe after they started filming, because there were these moments where they had you vibrate. You know, the film was vibrating, and it was really, really like, it wasn't just documenting you. It was like the film style was complimenting your energy. And I was really like, that was the most interesting to me. That made it more like art to me than just the storytelling. Because I love
it. It definitely it caught on quick to my favorite word, chaotic.
Yeah, it was definitely chaotic or chaotic.
Chaotic. Do you remember the it's my favorite word? It's chaotic, which is organized chaos. You know.
Oh, okay. It was the perfect tone for you. But we were really psyched to meet you in face to face, which is
that was the excuse we needed to get together, exactly.
And
long may they happen, you know. That's
Normally I'm pretty good at, you know, wiggling my way out of having to, you know, leave my, you know, my area. I've turned into quite a hermit, but you know, that was an easy one.
No, I'm with you. I think the, I was kind of saying, cause I've been drawn back into, there was a wonderful market we had yesterday. It was the, Sunday was our kind of a, they actually closed down Main Street in our little village. And, we had a sort of a Christmas market. So it's like a Sunday Christmas market, which was absolutely fantastic. And fair juice to my sister Clovis. She was a big part of sort of the organizing, cause it takes a small army to, you know, to sort of close down a village's main street and sort of coordinate with making sure that the bus or an ambulance and whatever else could get through if it needed to, and organizing everything. And so it was good because it was the sort of the last market of the year. We literally today now, it's 8 p.m. in the evening here. I've literally spent the day cooking the last few hams for Christmas. This is the last day of the year. I mean, roll on Christmas. We've all the guys have finished work. There won't be anybody else. It's just the family now in Gabin. So we had the big hurrah and said goodbye to all the gang. So yesterday was the last day of sort of, I suppose, manning the stalls and selling the wares and answering the phones and doing everything else. And it was a great way to do it on your home turf. And we had a little charity thing for, I set up a few knives that we're raffling out. And that was kind of great fun to see that kind of going to locals and everybody who was very kindly put their hands in the pocket for that. So it was fun doing it near a street, you know, in typical Irish weather, where luckily it didn't rain for 10 minutes.
Wow. So do you do like a Christmas party for the staff at Gabin or anything like that?
Not really. I think we do every so often kind of do a Christmas one. But do you know what? There's sort of like 20.
Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers. But that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science first supplementation. After adding ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Plus of us now at this stage, you know, more than 20 if you kind of take everybody with a part-time and stuff like that. So I think we're probably all quite knackered towards the end of the year. So it is nice to I suppose, if anything, you know, do you know that expression, herding cats?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, like organizing a staff party is kind of like herding cats, because half the crew can't make it. Most people do. And if they do, like it's a sort of, we're all different buzz and different things. So, but when it does happen every so often, we go big for it. And it's kind of lovely to have a nice meal and get everybody together. But I think we're close enough as a sort of a group that I think we kind of just thanked everybody in our own kind of way. And so I suppose we didn't do a staff party, but what we did kind of have was sort of, I suppose, you know, just the... It is something interesting about the end of the year, you know, because it's the only time the Gubbing kind of closes, you know, we're 24 hours, 7 days a week usually. So kind of when we shut the doors, you know, nobody's back until 2026, you know.
Yeah, we do the Fader Knives Christmas party always in late January, just because we're always like, you know, I'm going to be working. This year was really good for Fader Knives, and I'm like crazy. And I'm going to be working through Christmas. I'll take Christmas Day off, and then I'll take New Year's Day off, and then any days that my wife's taking off. She works in a clinic, so she's you know, doesn't have a lot of time off. But I'm not – usually I'll take the week off between Christmas and New Year's, but I'm so, like, backlogged, I'm just going to keep working through, which I like that. I grew up in the restaurant game, so I never really took long. And before, I mean, when I started working.
Make hay while the sun shines is the whole process.
Yeah,
I mean, like when you've grown up with that, you know. And I think there's no such thing as a, you know, we're not the type of people to sit in our asses.
Right.
You know, we don't go on a holiday to sit in a beach and stare out to sea. I don't think that's how we roll.
As I've gotten older, I do like that. When I teach with
I just got you and the budgie smuggler sitting on the beach now reading your books.
You know what? I'll tell you exactly what it is. It's not going to be a budgie smuggler yet. Give me a little bit older, and then I'll start fucking packing. I'll start packing my shorts. Okay.
I'll pack my shorts.
I'll have a bunch of fucking softballs in my pants, and I'll be lying on the beach. But my wife and daughter came in between classes at Florentine, and we went to the small beach town. We sent for like a few days, and we just rented out beach chairs, and I was just like, I can do this all day. And we just had drinks and we had lunch, and then we just stayed on the beach. I can do that as long as there's a big umbrella. But at the same time, it's taken me a long time to get there, and I feel as though it's because I tell myself, you do enough. You do more than enough. You're allowed to relax. So I can relax, but this particular year has been really, like, for me, it's been really it's been a lot of highs and lows in terms of the business and in terms of personal life. The death of my sister has really kind of awakened a lot in me, and right now I'm very, very grateful. I'm grateful for her, and I'm grateful for her inspiration. So I'm truly trying to do more. I'm trying to get more art out. My daughter's home until March, and then we're doing a lot more painting together, which has been a lot of fun. And I want to get back into sculpture, like, heavy duty, which is really, like, but it's like, I feel 2025 had a lot of highs and lows. And,
it can't be rainbows and unicorns, somebody once said.
No. But at the same time, in terms of when I think about relaxing, I think about, you know, I would like to, there's some sculpture I want to make. For vacation for me right now would be making some sculpture, which
Something constructive at the end of it. There's itches you want to scratch.
That to me is satisfaction. Mm. You know, making sculpture is now that it's not my career, not my business. It's something that something I want to do. So. Mm-hmm.
You got to be honest now, like, because I mean, David's not in with you at the moment, so you are literally on yourself on occasions. So I'm kind of, the question for you is, there that sneaky moment where, well, I suppose not now leading up to Christmas, but maybe there is that spontaneous moment where you would find yourself perhaps kind of going, actually, fuck it, no, let's lose yourself into something constructive. But,
well, here's
but
the interesting thing: when I had a guy here, I was very focused on the business.
It completely focuses you, especially.
Because you're paying them, and you want to make sure everything's going right. And then there's also, when you're an artist, also, there's this level of vulnerability, and you don't really want people looking at your creative process, because sometimes it's a little bit unorthodox. And I don't want that. And also, especially if someone's not an artist, they don't really understand art, they have this tendency to look at artists and look at the way you're creating, and they minimize it to a certain degree. I've been down that road, and I'm just like, I don't really, in my space, I don't really feel like, I don't really appreciate being in a vulnerable position while I'm being creative. I'm, you know, and it got to the point where I really made the shop for the last 3.5 years very, very shop oriented, not very creative in terms of sculpture. And then when he left, I pulled some sculpture out because I had some people come, and I was just like, you know what? I want to look at my sculpture. I want to be fired up about sculpture, and I want to look at it. I want to be creative. So I haven't stopped and said, I'm going to spend a couple hours doing this. I did have some painting set up so I could just kind of walk over and do a little bit of a paint here and there. But I want to be. I'm looking at my shop now. I'm in the shop now, and there's some things that I wish I had. Like, perfect example. The last couple episodes, I was talking about my sister's work, and my sister did mostly sculpture about these little tiny houses, and they're amazing.
Yeah.
And then my father, his painting really was steered towards landscapes of cities. So he would paint cities. So I'm starting to, you know, when you're by yourself all the time, you end up thinking a lot about things and kind of creating connections and stuff like that. And I made this real connection, the fact that my dad liked to do these cityscapes, and then my sister liked to make these houses, and I'm just like, you know, I need to kind of bridge the gap, and I have to.
I saw some pictures of your sister's workshop. It had a little bang of kind of Jimmy DiResta's original kind of old school. Remember the early days of DiResta's place? Yeah,
it's
was it
really,
a basement?
Really,
was it or
it's? She had a great basement. Yeah, she had a great basement, and her sculpture was very oriented in these little homes. And I really started to think about, I was thinking about it, and I really was just like, you know, how would I make the bridge this gap between my dad's work and my sister's work? And I was just like, I really wanted to make my interpretation of a steel version, like a 4-foot steel version of the Eiffel Tower. Mm-hmm. I want to make a gas welded steel Eiffel Tower. And I thought about that all day today, and I was just like, that would be so much fun. I wish I had this space where I could just set my torches up and I could walk over and work on this sculpture, and I just don't have that. So
what would be your
question,
twist on
I'd
that?
Like to,
I mean, what's your twist on the
I just think that I've done so much. I've done the sculpture to me that I've done that's the most like drawing. Is I started back in college, we did oxyacetylene welding where you have a very small torch and then you have 1/8-inch wire, which is like a coat hanger wire.
Yeah.
And then the torch is set so, you know, very low. It's like 7 pounds of acetylene and then like 10 pounds of oxygen. And it's just like this very tiny little flame. And you're able to kind of weld together fusing steel together. And then if you hold the torch back, you can bend the steel. And then you end up, the more proficient you get, it becomes the closest thing to drawing in 3 dimensions, which is, I've done it for years, and I did all these birds, and I did all this sculpture, and I did these, you know, egrets and all these goddamn things. And I loved it. And it was really like, you can kind of move your ass.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do that version of the Eiffel Tower. I just thought it would be this kind of, I haven't really figured out how I'm going to do it, but I really kind of feel like that's something. And I was today, the only thing when you said,
Sometimes you don't know until you start, you know, like it will kind of,
I wanted,
kind of unfold as you
I really kind of wanted, I could see myself doing like a lot of different variations. Like in my mind, I was thinking, well, how would you start to do it? And then I was thinking about when I was a fabricator and how I would lay out, you know, the four, you know, you only need to do one side and do it 4 times, and then you can start to kind of fuck around with the girders and all that. So I really had a very, very, to answer your question about if do I ever think cheeky, I had planned out if I had the space in my shop and I was able to do it, I know exactly how I would make this. I just have to figure out I might do some drawings of the Eiffel Tower. I just thought it would be a kind of like this neat connection between my dad and my sister and the steelwork that I've done over the years. And so that, to answer your question, is the answer is yes. I think about these things a lot.
Fantastic. That's it. Yeah. Let the creative juices flow. Go to it, bud.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, it's Christmas time, and this time of the year, we usually just kind of slowly, like you were saying, slow down a little bit. And just kind of like, we are together. My daughter's home for a while, which we're really happy about. And we're getting ready for, we're going to do a Feast of Seven Fishes dinner with my next door neighbor, which has turned into this great
You haven't got the carp in the bathtub, do you?
No. you know, here's the funny thing is,
have you heard about that one? You know that that's an actual thing.
No, tell me about it.
No, literally, I think it's the Polish. There's a few other kind of Eastern European countries,
and they would literally. Fan.
Yeah, but I'm not really here either. It's kind of more of a lake fish, isn't it, or a river fish?
Yeah.
But the I think the principle was to actually go out and find the carp, well before Christmas, But you'd actually keep it in your bathtub. You'd keep it alive until the day itself. Ugh, you know, that was part of the process. It was part of the whole tradition. I kind of like the idea. And I can just see the kids playing and teasing this fucking giant fish that's like kind of living in your bathtub.
Yeah. We're doing, the Feast of Seven Fishes has turned into something kind of, we've been doing it for about 5 years. And it's this fun Italian-American thing where you have to have seven courses of fish. Mm-hmm. And it's so there's 1 year where I made course after course and it was like such a production. And then this year we're just going to fuck around with some clams and some mussels and some shrimp and stuff like that. But we have our next door neighbor over who lost his wife a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. So we kind of take care of him for the holidays. And it's just,
I think it is important to have a few extra heads around. I mean, part of me kind of yearns for a nice, quiet, easy one. But, you know, what makes kind of Christmas is probably having people around you and you know, going that extra bit. Like, it, like I've said in previous years, there's the Christmas swim. The family gets up and you're down there for, midday, everybody freezing their ass off with tinsel around their neck, runs into the sea, comes out pretending they're not cold, sort of knocks back some whiskey, throws on the woolly socks and then, home you go. But the... that's probably after the Christmas swim is literally when I start cooking. It is one of those things you prep all day. And
But what's your main Christmas, like, you're preparing for Christmas dinner. I know that you pick out the hams and you pick out the thing. You have a big family and stuff like that. When are you going to start doing your prep for Christmas?
Well, I've cooked the ham tonight. So I've got the ham is already steamed and ready. So, I mean, you've got to kind of skin it back and glaze it and kind of you're going to reheat it on the day. And then my father-in-law, he's already organized the turkey, so we'll probably, I'm not going to cook a whole turkey. We actually had that was really funny. We have some geese on the farm, and there's the traditional kind of white goose that everybody would recognize, and then you have the Toulouse goose, which has kind of got blacker wings, but it looks like a very typical goose. And we were gifted some Chinese geese. Huh. Which have kind of a different look about them. They're sort of the skinnier version of geese, much noisier. But they actually, because they were younger geese, they bred very well this year. So we had a yard full of these Chinese geese who went off for the chop the day before yesterday. So we're going to collect them tomorrow. So I think we have this huge feast of a combination of turkey and geese and ham and all these sort of things that'll be going on. But I tend to not do like large birds like that in one kind of like wanky Christmas typical sort of like out it comes this giant thing. I break it into pieces. It's like, why would you take an entire cow and cook it in one go? Because every part of the cow likes to be cooked kind of differently. You know, you can eat a fillet in a certain way, you slow braise and slow cook certain cuts, so I think in some way for me, why fuck up half the bird cooking the huge thing in one go, where you can actually spend a lot less time, break them down to components, have more fun with it, and have tastier kind of things that are a lot less stressful.
This is why I don't understand the whole hog thing. I've eaten
hog. Again, it's another wanky showing off thing. It's a sort of a whole feast for the eyes more than anything else.
It sucks, as far as I'm concerned. And
it can be done well. It can be done well, but at the same time, it's how much time. Like I when I was younger, I used to do pigs on spits all the time because we were like, we had pigs at the farm. It was kind of expected, if not thought of, and I was wedding catering and, who doesn't want to have a grand feast? I mean, we all fucking grew up reading Asterix. You know what I mean? There's a whole sort of Obelix.
Obelix, kind of
holding an entire leg and sort of chewing on it. It is the ultimate image of sort of celebration and sort of feasting. But I mean, you eat half a pig, you don't really feel like dancing for a while afterwards.
Right.
It sits heavy, but it is the whole process of actually like, what's the Philippines? They do the whole thing.
Lechon.
And that's got this beautiful crispy shell and there's a sort of a sweetness and a soy sauce. They do a beautiful kind of thing. And I think the Italians, where they roll up the whole...
That makes a lot of sense.
That makes sense to me. The porchetta, exactly. So there are people who are doing it well. And I think that if you have the patience and the time to do it, like in America, to be fair, tip of the hat to all the amazing to all kinds of, I should be remembering all kinds of names now, but there is the whole process of the pit cooked pigs down in the South America, like that is incredible. I mean, when it's done well,
I just think I've had it bad. But like you were saying, in terms of every piece is always going to be different. I've had that problem where I've gone to a few places and it looks great, and then all of a sudden something's greasy and something is kind of not, it's just not really tender, and some parts are and some parts aren't, and it's just like, I feel like it's like almost a waste of a life. I've gotten to the point now.
I know exactly what you mean by that.
If you don't do a good job, you're taking for granted a life is lost for this terrible meal.
Yeah, you want to do the justice, and I think
the
thing is that if you have good weather and opportunity, and if you are based down in Memphis or you're based in somewhere where, you know, the sun is shining and you've got all the time in the world and you're a laid back son of a bitch and you're just going to do it properly and do it all day and you kind of wake up at all hours of the morning and you're going to cook yourself some hog, you know, you can commit yourself. So A, you get a good animal, you do the whole process and you do it properly. But I think if you have that intention and you're in Ireland and the fucking gale force storm comes in and the wind's blowing through, you know, and the shoulders are half raw and your bellies are getting burnt. I mean, I've told you the stories of my disastrous previous attempts to sort of cook pigs at festivals. And
go ahead. Tell me the worst one.
I think that fellow knife makers, Sam Gleason, he was helping me, and we were up in the Dungarvan Food Festival, and a great friend of mine who actually owns the a restaurant up there said, "Oh, come up! It's a nice little cozy festival. You know, nothing to worry about." You know, so my dad, I asked Dad, "All right, look, send a pig off. We're going to." And it's this huge pig arrived back. I said, "Fuck it! That's strike one. This large pig." Sort of arrived, and I had the spit, which is the typical one where you sort of lift the lever and you turn it 15 degrees kind of every 5 minutes and slowly rotates, and you don't want the far side to get cold while the bottom, you know, it's a whole manual process as opposed to sort of a motor. And, you know, had the van full of wood, had the fires going, and so eventually you kind of start cooking this pig early in the morning, get the whole bowl going, all the stalls start to set up around us, they start up putting up their screens, and I'm getting smoke in my eyes already. Said this doesn't bode well, so the smoke is going in my eyes. We know that the food, the EHO, the environmental health officer for the area, is quite strict and tough, so we're kind of like, first of all, shitting it, because, you know, you're setting up like a total cowboy in the middle of a square in a town. You're sort of like lighting fires on the street, and you know there's a thousand things that can go wrong. So, you know, you're waiting for the tarmac to catch fire, and you're waiting for all the usual things to go on. So this giant pig is turning away, and I remember, you know, because it starts to attract attention very quickly.
Yeah, of course,
and
people watching, they want to see.
Yeah. And we're doing it old school. It's not that typical, you know, stainless steel box. This is good old school open fire, you know, and a giant pig with. And a friend of mine has this tradition of what we call this sort of you know, when you score the skin, which when the skin becomes the crackling, it will actually kind of open up and becomes. So we do almost like a tribal kind of Celtic kind of design. So as it kind of cooks, it kind of becomes quite beautiful. So we have a little competition now about who can do the most beautiful kind of crackling scoring. And it's almost tribal art. So we're doing this and doing the whole process. And I remember that the environmental health officer is about to show up. So we're getting everything sorted out. We have the area for the raw meat. We have the area for the cooked meat. We have the temperature probes. We have all the paperwork. We have the whole thing. So the I'm just getting ready and everything's happening. And along comes there's a famous kind of TV show called Nationwide, which is sort of, I suppose, very agriculturally based, but everything that's happening in the country, and they decide to film. So they're like, "Do you mind if we film you? And I'm going to ask you a few questions." I'm like, "Fair enough." So we have the pig in the background, and it's turning away, and you know, sort of. So the camera crew is recording the entire thing. This lovely lady who obviously isn't much of a food lover herself, and I sort of have the interview from. It was kind of it was okay, but I remember it sort of being, you know, sort of torturous enough in the whole occasion. And then afterwards, the EHO kind of arrives and is sort of, we're walking through and I'm explaining all the things. And my great friend Luca, who's from Italy, comes over and goes, Finga. And I'm like, "Luca, not now, Luca." It's like, Finga. The pig is on fire. So what had happened was a giant paella pan which we used to carve things into, had been left over the heat for a little bit too long, and it had heated up the kind of a bit of the grease, and the grease caught fire, and then that jumped up. So one side kind of gets a bit charred. So I go over, throw a tea towel over it. Fine job. Turn the pig over. Grant, no problem. You know, it's you either panic or you sort it out. So, you know, 5 minutes, Grant, go back to the EHO. Oops, sorry about that. This is a temperature probe. Go through the whole process. And this giant pig is taking forever to cook. So we have people queuing for forever. And eventually we get the food out. We're serving it out. We're sort of doing little portions of sort of roasted potatoes with garlic and rosemary. And we have the sort of the you know, people getting a little bit of the crackling and getting a bit of the pork. And like you were saying, you know, there's bits that are absolutely ready and there's bits that we have to heat up a little bit longer.
Yeah.
So we're fighting away with this. And I remember my newly acquired parents-in-law, my wife's parents rocked up and you know, so I'm sort of hugging, helloing and everybody. I had this incredible team with me. But I remember sort of that point where you bite off more than you can chew and you just find yourself like usually surrounded by friends in a small, cozy scenario. Whereas instead, I was in a fucking huge food festival in the middle of this sort of very large town on the verge of being a city. It's sort of like with smoke in my eyes and the whole thing. And it was like thing after thing after thing after very little sleep and the whole process. And I remember at the end of the day just being absolutely exhausted and setting everything, you know, taking everything down and putting it all away and thanking everybody. And they're all getting up. And I remember getting into the car and I was absolutely and utterly blind. I had been boxed off with the smoke that my eyes had actually gone so bloodshot from the day of being boxed in with the actual smoke and, you know, the whole process. And along the way, like I mentioned, you know, the road had started to caught fire, you know, the tarmac, so they started to put sand. Everything was a little disaster that was just a hair's breadth away from being, you know, a complete calamity. But, you know, it's these are the times that test you, you know, and I think I have an incredible, one of my closest and dearest friends, Ted Berner, who's called Wildside Catering. We all used to go and help him. So, of course, Ted is Swedish, but been living in Ireland forever. We kind of went to school together a couple of years below me. But he is inspirational because he's one of those guys that you just can't face. You honestly think, you know, the coolest, most laid back guy in the world. But experience is everything. And I think, you know, I suppose there are points where you could just literally curl up in a ball and cry, you know, like that whole scene where you just want to like pretend this didn't happen and just fucking slither away and pretend it let everything go away. But it doesn't. You have to just kind of get up and get on with it. And there's an amazing celebration when, you know, like in a restaurant, when the tickets are flying in and you're gung-ho and everything is sort of boom boom boom, you know, things will go wrong. Restaurant like cookers will stop working, machineries will go wrong, power cuts will happen, everything like that. It's how you rise to those situations. And I think that a lifetime of those, I mean, like I'm nearly 50 and I think I've seen and experienced most things. And there are people in your life that inspire you to kind of like just get on with it, you know. Don't fucking panic right now. Take a deep breath, think about it, and if you see enough little things, do you know, like that's the thing you wish for the next generation. If everything is too fucking easy and you've walked into a sweet scenario, as soon as you meet your first problem, you know, you're going to crumble. You know, you have to feel like if you're one of two people, you either have a thicker skin or you don't. But life is about experiences, about sort of meeting hurdles and how you handle those. And I'm not the best at it. I'm by no means saying that I'm good at it, but I think I've seen enough shit shows that I've actually come out the other side of it. And I've learned from those to prevent them from happening again. But also, you start to almost see them before they happen, if enough things. If you throw yourself into the deep end enough, and I think that's one of the biggest things in life, is just fucking throw yourself into the deep end. You know, because if you don't, then, you know, you're not going to rise up to the challenges. You're not going to push yourself and so on and so forth. And then, you know, look, I think here ends my monologue. But that was my
sort of... I love that. I think that it's really important to put yourself in a tough position. I think that you're 100,000% right.
Make the mess. Make the mess, huh?
You got to figure it out because otherwise it's just not, you're never going to like, you need that experience. But I was wondering actually what you were saying is, do you think you could give me, I'm just changing up a little bit only because I want to track back to what you were saying before. What is the flavor profile of a goose. I mean, you're going to be serving all this goose. What's a goose? Is it a duck that's just a little bit gracier?
Yeah, well, just a bigger version of it. Yeah, I think sometimes duck can be a little bit gamier, funny enough, than a goose. It is definitely a redder meat by far, and it does have that kind of same amount of fat like you would see. And God, what were the, do you remember, I don't know if you ever had, it's probably more of this side of the world, but there was a wonderful TV show called Two Fat Ladies.
We love Two Fat Ladies because she would say, eat your meat, Clarissa. I remember because my wife and I would watch it, and these two old bags would make the craziest food. I'll never forget.
Magical women. I think it means the world because I feel like I'm almost related to a lot of characters kind of like that. And it's like the people who would never throw away the goose fat. That was for roasting your potatoes. It was a treasure. And it was, you know, the people who, like, if anything, back in the day, went through a war, went through everything, they learned how to stretch things and things that were a pleasure to sort of, you know. Yeah.
I love that show. Mm. But I also got to tell you a funny enough story when you're mentioning Asterix. To the listeners, Asterix is one of the great it's kind of a comic book.
Yeah.
And it was translated from in every language, and it was the story of Asterix in this little village in France,
Gaul.
It was Gaul, surrounded by the Roman Empire, and this little guy Asterix and then his big fat friend Obelix, and they were, you know, they had magic potions and they would fight the stories are unbelievable.
The names obsessed. Of the characters. I remember the fishmonger was called Unhygienix.
Vital statistics and cacophonics. It was just fun. It was funny. The drawings were great, and they always ate wild boar, and they'd have these big events with these wild boars all the time. And you see the drawings, and you're just like, I really want. So one day, my dad said to me for my birthday, "If you could eat anything you wanted, what would it be?" And I said, "Dad, I've always wanted wild boar. We're living in fucking Manhattan, you know." And my dad says, "I will get you wild boar," and he made wild boar with like blah 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 blah. A year later, he told me, "By the way, those are just pork chops."
Yeah,
it wasn't wild boar at all. I'm thinking, I'm just going to be like the comic books, and I'm going to eat wild boar, and it was just pork chops with like potatoes or something like that.
I love it. That's it. I mean, do you remember the whole thing about an asterisk was you'd start reading it because there were always a bunch of them next to the toilet in our house. And it was always that point where you'd read it for so long that your legs would get pins and needles. I just remember you kind of like a good shit was about half an asterisk.
Oh, geez. I would always read them. When I was very young, I would read them in bed while I was eating cereal.
I remember
lying in bed eating a bowl, like a salad bowl of cereal, watching, you know, reading Asterix. I have all of them. I still have all. I have all the Tintins, too.
It was a wedding present from my great friend to us, actually, when we got married, myself and Kira, when we got married, my great friend Wally gave us the actual entire collection. And so my kids now have been reared thanks to his wonderful wedding present.
They're great.
Yeah. It's a wonderful idea. But my favorite quote, I think, was the, do you remember Asterix and the Soothsayer?
Support for this podcast is brought to you by Walden University. Ever catch yourself thinking, what if I could go after what I actually want and really make a difference? You're not alone. And that's exactly why I want to tell you about Walden University. For over 50 years, Walden has helped working adults like you get the W with the knowledge and skills to build the future you want and make a difference where it matters most. If you've been waiting for the right moment, this is it. Head to waldenu.edu and take that first step. Walden University, set a course for change, certified to operate by Chev.
There.
Yes.
Yes. So there's this wonderful scene with a guy who's kind of been sent to sort of tear the village apart and sort of become an instigator that sort of makes them all fight and fall out. And part of the magic, I thought, was the scene where there was a storm outside. Remember, there's the thing about thunder. They always was convinced that it was the sky was going to fall on our heads.
That's right.
So the soothsayer, and half the village thinks he's full of shit and he's a liar. So he actually goes up to the entire crowd and it kind of goes, "Once this storm finishes, the weather will get better." I remember it, a moment later, the storm stops and everybody comes out. My God, he's a soothsayer. I now always have that favorite quote about once the weather gets better. There you go. Once the storm finishes,
It was such a great comic. It was so, you know, those comic. I think that Asterix and Tintin were my favorite of all time. And a lot of it
Tintin.
Was the
I was
going to
say that. Yeah, it is actually. I met one of the ladies who was actually one of the graphics people for Asterix. She was one of the people involved because those guys. I can't even pronounce it, but there was two gentlemen who started it. But
right.
There was a team involved in the whole thing, and I met her, and we still have the little sketch that she did when she came over.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. I mean, it's like you said, it's the thing of childhoods, I suppose, isn't it? To read those.
Those comics, when I was growing up, Tintin was not frowned upon because my family thought it was from, my mother thought it was from, because it was from Belgium, that maybe it was a little bit more kind of like thoughtful. And it wasn't just like, you know, Batman and Spider-Man and shit.
Yeah, yeah.
So I loved, Tintin was amazing. And one of the interesting things about Tintin was we went to the museum, we went to Brussels, we went to the Tintin Museum. And what was interesting is like it started out as just like a comic book. And then as the years went on, they would hire architect draftsmen. Mm-hmm. Because the drawings were so architecturally sound that Hergé was who created Tintin. Hergé comes from the letters H and G, if you were to spell it out. So it first name was H something and the last name was G something.
Yeah.
So if you put H and G together, it's Hergé. Mm-hmm. And he really focused on, you know, draftsmen. He wanted architectural draftsmen to do the drawings of the comic. So I think that when I think of my youth and I think of your kids and I think of my daughter as well, is you think of these kind of very important little parts about growing up and
surprisingly
Christmas time,
ageless as well in some ways.
Yeah.
I think you could probably be in another generation's time, somebody would happily read Asterix, you know, to their kids and I think that it's not something you actually probably read to your kids. You actually just introduce it to them at the right time. I think it's
I think I seem to remember Tomer's kids had some Asterix comics too. So
yeah.
It's like it is an amazing part of my childhood for sure. So back to Christmas and New Year's. So how many people will be at your house for a Christmas dinner?
Probably about 15-ish, I suppose. It depends.
Oh, wow,
I'll get the numbers. Yeah, there could be. I mean, like, I have to remember, there's five kids. And then you put the three sort of, there'll be three-ish families, kind of two or three. I mean, like, it's Kira's gang, mine, and then our whole bunch, and then whatever else happens at the time. But yeah, that'll be grand. Absolutely.
And
fine.
How is the, what is your drinking choices throughout the night? What do you start off with?
Well, I usually we kind of pop down to the house because the kids are going to get their Christmas presents from my folks. So we'll kind of slide down there, and you know, there's a little bit of sort of smoked salmon on top of, you know, with some eggs on toast, you know, like little scrambled, very lightly scrambled eggs on toast with some smoked salmon, little bubbles. I mean, if I'm, you know, black velvet, where you put a little bit of stout on top of champagne. So you start off with, God, which way around is it? It's actually, because it's only once a year. Somebody's going to be shouting it, but I think you pour a bit of stout into your glass first, like a sort of a larger wine glass, a much bigger one. And we have these kind of goblets, and then you put a bit of stout on top, because you know you can put like orange juice and champagne together. I mean, we're probably drinking cava. You don't use the good stuff for this, but But it's called black velvet, so it's a stout and sort of cava or bubbles kind of combo. And I do love it dearly.
So what's the proportions?
Fuck knows. Until it tastes good.
Like half of like more champagne
probably would be around that. Yeah, I always wing it. It's one of those things. It's like a good Bloody Mary. Now you just sort of like, oh, that looks about right. You know, gin and tonic. A great friend of mine, Ivan is a devil for. He actually has a weighing scales in his house because he uses it for everything, and it's always on. So he does his gin and tonic to ratio, but using weight, which is quite clever because it's always there and it's always on in the corner. So he'll throw his gin into X amount, you know, tear, boom, there you go. Because he uses it for his coffee or for whatever else. And I think that's an interesting way of doing it, because I'm not really one to kind of take out a little measuring thing and do, fuck that. No, I mean, it's going to taste good either way. And you know what? If anything, just put a bit more tonic in, you know. But
I think when I make a Manhattan, I do that. I measure for a Manhattan. That's about it.
Oh, actually, do you know what was it? I was experimenting last night. There was an American bartender came up with Birricano. I think it's like a Negroni meets a sort of a Negroni meets a beer cocktail. Like what do they have down in Mexico
Oh.
when you it's it, you know like
Oh, the it's a I
Michelada,
know what
a
you're
Michelada. So
Mitchell,
it
yeah.
yeah, so, but a Birricano is like is a sort of a sweet vermouth. What do you put into a Negroni? The
Gin
red
and then Campari,
Campari.
right?
Thank you, Campari, and then your beer, and then you kind of froth up a bit of the beer, and that's your sort of. So it's
Oh.
basic. It's okay, but I think you have to get the right beer. I think I was drinking it with the wrong beer,
Huh.
in there, but it actually was quite refreshing. But yeah, no, I find myself, I'm going back into my little sherry state at the moment. A really
Oh,
good little,
sippy.
oh yeah, nice, like a nice dry fino. I've got actually right next to me now, I have an Amontillado. The world of sherries is fascinating. Like, did you know that if you are drinking into sherry in Spain, for example, the so we know that kind of whiskey can be it has to be at least 5 years old. Good whiskeys are kind
Okay.
of like 12 years old. They can go on and on. So you can, like the Spanish will sort of drop hundreds of euros on buying a jamón. Irish will spend, probably a good bit of money buying some good whiskey. We all see these things that are worth investing in that are sort of our little pleasure givers.
And heritage too.
Yeah. And, to enjoy and celebrate at the right time. Sherry is a fascinating one because we're talking about these things being of a certain age. But a sherry and a sherry cask is topped and tailed. You take some out, you put some in. So the actual sherry cask itself has a penicillium, kind of like a sort of a mold floor. The barrel's on its side. So all this liquid is in these large sherry casks and barrels, and you're getting the oxidization and you're getting the sort of the element of from the barrels themselves. But what happens is that those sherry kind of cask can go back, hundreds of years, 20 years, 30, whatever it is. Like, so if you think of it's sort of like a mother of sorts, and the amount of time that the actual sherry spends in that vinegar, sorry, in the actual barrel will affect the flavor. So you have Amontillado, your Fina, your Manzanilla, Cortados. So you have different types of sherries. Each one, you're playing with the ratio of the amount of oxidization, the amount of time in the cask, the amount of time you age it, and so on and so
Huh.
forth. And some, like if you have a, you have you heard of PX sherry? Like a really amazing with
I don't know
vanilla ice cream.
sherry very well. I don't know
So
sherry very well.
the XO sauce and all these kind of things that people are talking about. Yeah,
Yes,
so PX
yes. And they're using
is
sherry vinegar.
Pedro Ximenez. It's the one that almost tastes like it's a fig or a date syrup. It's so thick and sweet and rich. So that's a sherry, but that's a very, very sweet sherry. And then you have the finos, which are the dry, and you have so many different variations. So some are like there's almost like a little hint of blue cheese off some of the sherries, and then you have
Okay.
your sort of different ones. And it's a love or hate thing. It's a marmite. You grow up with it.
Right.
You kind of grow to love it. It's one of those things that just gets under your skin, and you kind of appreciate it. And it comes from, I think. Like, especially if you're in Spain itself and the sun is hitting your back, you've had a wonderful day and you're kind of starting to tuck into the tapas, and you kind of have that perfect bite, that perfect olive, that perfect piece of jamón. The little sherry is served to you in an atmosphere that's rich with sort of that loud sort of Spanish, shouting voices all around you, and the environment is right. It'll sort of turn the key for your enthusiasm towards it, and I think that happened to me many years ago. And I'm kind of my adventures are continuing with it. So I kind of see sherry as being an adventure. I've kind of embraced the Marmite element of it, literally.
Well, the thing is like you've become your the food at Gabin, the cheeses and the meats and stuff like that are very inspired by your family's history in Spain and then in being in Ireland and stuff like that. Do you, and hearing you talk about sherry, do you think you'd ever get involved with the alcohol industry?
Well, Ireland's too wet and too cold, I suppose, for like we don't have the ability to really grow grapes. I think it's been attempted a couple of times, but we don't have that. So you'd probably be fighting with mold and everything else, all these kind of things that would probably make life too hard. You wouldn't have the sun for the sugars to come out, and So I don't see that. So I think that, I suppose you can bite off more than, you know, back to that expression, bite off more than you can chew. I suppose, like, I feel like we've already chosen some of the hardest things to make already between sort of charcuterie and cured meats and cheese, because the fuckers don't play ball when you want them to. You know, the vast majority of the time, you're challenged. I mean, you've grown up in the wineries. You know that you have to duck and weave with Mother Nature to kind of like steer it in the direction of consistency. So I suppose that the alcohol is fascinating. I mean, part of me's always wanted to sort of crack open a still or crack in, you know, get the experiments going and sort of try and make some. But I think that part of the unattractive side of the booze industry is probably dealing with all the bonding and, you know, the whole element of taxation and sort of how much you're allowed to make. And, you know, There's a huge amount of regulation with alcohol, especially with if the Irish found out that there's a cheap source of booze somewhere, you'd make a lot of fucking friends fast. So I think bonding alcohol in Ireland is a very severe thing, because there's actually, I mean, the amount of tax that the government gets off of alcohol is incredible. It's taxed very heavily to, one, reduce people drinking, and B, to actually sort of, you know, aid the government so they don't fuck around.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned my father, because there was a Christmas, an event, as my father's a winemaker, and he pioneered this particular grape. Mm-hmm. It was called Sauval Blanc, which was a Native American and French hybrid, I mm-hmm. believe. And because it really could handle the cold winters.
Yeah.
And there was one Christmas day that was like so cold, it killed everything.
Yeah.
And it was a frost. It killed the vines for that year. They didn't, you didn't have to replace everything, but it killed the vines for that year.
Yeah. It knocked fucking sparks out of it. Yeah.
They called it the Christmas Day Massacre.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden he didn't have a vintage. And what he ended up having to do was he, my father was very resourceful, and he teamed up with a friend of his who was an apple grower, and they made apple wine for that year. And it was like a really kind of an interesting, you know, way to, you know, figure out what to do in that situation, because he wasn't buying grapes at the time.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. You're at the mercy of, I mean,
there's a thousand ways to make alcohol. I mean, like there's everybody has a way. I mean, even the Irish putchine, which is the, you know, the spirit alcohol made from like potato skins and, you know, whatever else. You just need starch and you need a few other things. I told you about the turning cheese whey into alcohol, did I?
No.
So there's a method called the Carbery process, which is where you take cheese whey, which is, of course, Ireland, we have cows, milk, you make your cheese, the leftover liquid is the whey. And what happens, you can add, there's a particular protected, as in it's a secret, kind of strain of yeast that you add to the cheese whey, and that will create a mash, which you can then distill, and that will create, it doesn't have the sexiest name in the world, but that's ethanol. That's basically your booze, which can then be used to go on. And you can make an amazing gin. You can then put your botanicals in, and you can take that on to make an incredible gin or do everything else. But I find that... Do you remember, did you go see that phase of Alka-Pops? Remember fucking disgustingly colored, sort of, they looked like kids drinks, but they were Alka, like there was Fat Frog and there was all these things that sort of had like a coloring, and it was basically tapping into the sort of teenage market of a sort of like a ethanol being put on top of a sort of a, you know, a soda. And and it was,
when was that, what years were that, what was this, what,
I don't know, this? They're probably still fucking doing it. It's just, you know, it's just, I remember there was that whole period of, basically imagine having your booze and you're just adding it to a sugary drink, you know, that's technically what they're doing, and they're putting it into a can, you know, and then you're into a branding project. But that shit used to give you a fucking hangover like a son of a bitch.
Yeah.
You know it's kind of like the White Claw, you know, like that's probably a good example. White Claw, right. It's probably one of those.
Well, my growing up in the 80s, there was a wine coolers really took off, and it was like a sweet.
But that's more of a spritz, isn't it? Or what do they call them? Yeah.
It was very sweet. I mean, it might as well have been soda. But you know, the interesting thing was, and this is something that I remember having a conversation with my dad, because you know I was born in the 70s, And when his first vintage was 79, and I remember in the, like, I would say probably, so when I was about 10 or 11, I started really showing interest in the winery, and I would say it, and we would talk about wine. My dad wasn't a big wine drinker. Like, at night he had Dewars. He had a glass of Dewars at night.
What's Dewars? It's a type of glass, if it's type Dewars, of bourbon.
Yeah, Scotch.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, Dewars is a you know, Scotch whiskey.
Is that spelled,
I
mean, the same? Dewar.
Yeah.
Like our, your liquid nitrogen Dewar.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Exactly. Dewars was like Dewars White Label was his drink. So, okay. I remember he would tell me that, like, you know, white wine is, you know, generally, you know, either on the drier side or on the, you know, the kind of fruitier, sweeter side, and the drier side is better suited for dinner while you're eating dinner and stuff like that and stuff like that. And yeah. I said to him at one point, I said, well, what's going to happen if everyone's drinking Coca-Cola and Pepsi and sodas and sweet sodas? How's that going to affect their, you know, desire? And I'm saying this as a 10-year-old, so I'm not sounding as, you know, articulate as I am now. But I said, what's going to happen to the people drinking Coca-Cola and Pepsi? And when it comes to drinking wine later in life, won't they be interested in drinking sweeter wines? And he says, yeah, you got a good point. And then when they started doing wine coolers, it seemed as though that was the case with the American taste for wines, which was far more, people were more interested in sweeter drinks. And it is interesting how tastes have changed.
What's your nemesis? Like, what's the one that would sort of, that you don't want to, but if you did find yourself, you know, like, would you have a little weak moment with a really good beer or kind of wine or cocktails or some sort of thing that actually you can have a moment of letting yourself go and having fun with the environment's kind of right? What would you actually get lost with?
Well, I'll tell you what, we've been having, ever since I finished the marathon, I've been drinking a little bit more, and I've been noticing I get hangovers much easier. So I'm not drinking.
Oh, condition training is everything, my friend. I can tell you all about that.
But the hangovers are so bad. Like, if I had three, on my birthday, somebody gave me some tequila and I had a couple beers. Mm-hmm. I felt like shit the next day, the entire day, to the point where I'm like, I can't do this.
The sneaky hangover. Yeah. They can come on you.
I had some hazy IPAs that I liked very much. Mm-hmm. Recently, I had a friend of mine gave you Manhattan with, instead of vermouth, they used Amaro.
Oh yeah.
In it, and it was outstanding. I liked that very much. I had a vodka on the rocks, just vodka on the rocks. Recently, that I really, really, like. Mm. And I do in Christmas time, I do like champagne or I like champagne. And then a customer of mine gave me about 5 years ago, gave me a really expensive bottle of wine. He says, don't drink it until at least 2025. Okay. And my kid just turned 21,
you have
so
the
she
excuse.
Can drink.
Yeah.
So we're gonna drink this like a $600 bottle of wine. So we're going to knock that back. But you know, I enjoy drinking, but at the same time, like it's not the end all be all for me. So I don't really get, I don't get lusty about things anymore.
I'm all about lust. I'm the
I know
lustiest motherfucker
I was
in the world.
Just
the
like
greedy
you. I was
gluttons.
Just like you. When I was a kid, I was trying to bond with my dad and he was such a glutton. And I was like, I tried to bond with him over that. And then, as I got older, it was so exhausting keeping up with the food trends. And then, you know, your RL friend, Nick Solaris. Remember Nick Solaris?
Yeah.
Nick is this unbelievable guy. Nick Solaris is unbelievable. And he was a writer for...
He's the new...
Eater, yeah.
And he's great the sort of the beef guru of all
great
the fantastic
guy.
Places
really
to eat.
Really English guy living in New York. And he was really like... classic, and he would do these food reviews, and not food reviews, but he would talk about going to steakhouses, and then he'd bring in, you know, anytime he went to steakhouse, he'd wear his, you know, an English suit with the Union Jack flag on his thing, and he'd have, you know, he'd bring in his own steak knives, and they were Tomer steak knives, and I remember listening to him talk about the etiquette of eating. Well, when you order prime rib, you got to eat the seventh rib from the third side. And it was like, and he was just talking about what's right and what's wrong. And it was so, it was so exhausting to me that I was just like, Well, I got a prime. I went to a steakhouse before I went to the Knicks game. I got the prime rib. I was like, it fucking tastes fine.
Yeah.
And I was just so, I got so over being so overly excited about food that I just.
Well, do you know, I'm excited about food, but I was talking to Kira the other day, and we were during a meal, somebody asked me about my favorite meal. And actually, I think one of my favorite meals was eaten over a bin. It was literally, there was a friend's restaurant up in Dublin, and he was full to the brim, but we were only in town. He said, come over. So we were outside the front, and there wasn't any room inside because he's a tiny restaurant, but he brought up, kept bringing, himself and his sister kept bringing out food to us. So all these little nibbles kept coming out, and there was like literally a sort of a bike, like a delivery bike, kind of, but a bicycle delivery bike. Was kind of there, and you know, just things kind of little basket, a little bit of, and then a little wine came out. And I remember like this fucking feast was appearing in front of us outside, and we were having the fucking time of our lives. And all these people in the restaurant kind of looking out the window, like, who the fuck are these guys outside? You know, being brilliant. We were getting all these little nibbles and these little starters off menu things, and it was, we were treated like royalty. But we had over a bin. Literally, it was one of those. It was that, and that was, I wouldn't have changed a thing. I don't want to go to, I'm getting to a point now where I don't want to go and eat a 6 hour long. I'm not going to complain about it, but I'm not leaning as much towards going to sort of a Michelin star restaurant and eating for 6 hours and having 27 courses.
Yeah. You
know, it is going to be fascinating. There's a time and a place for it, but I want to be with friends, shooting the shit, having fun, like, if anything, eating over a bin, you know,
okay,
in the right environment, okay, with something that at least is new, different, or exciting, or tasty, or kind of fun. That to now me,
gonna,
yeah, yeah.
Now I'm going to put you on the spot here. It's your death row day. Death okay. row day. Give me your death row 3-meal day: breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Do you know what? If it probably suits this side of the world more, but there's a fantastic podcast called The Go-To Food Pod. It's very much based around London. But if you've ever been or worked in the food industry, it's a podcast based for restaurateurs and sort of people from the industry, as opposed to punters. So I think when they interview all the restaurateurs and people who own these amazing places, and they're prolific podcasters, they're literally working their way around London and everywhere like that. The interview is very much aimed towards, you know, your day from hell, your experiences, and you know what's your favorite starter, your favorite main, your favorite dessert, that kind of thing. And so they go through that, and it's a fantastic formula, but it kind of triggered that, because what I love about it is, you know, there's that wonderful point where you get a restaurateur to actually talk like a human being and not like, oh, fuck it, my customers are probably listening. Like right now.
Yeah.
You know, when we're on Knife Talk, you know, it's a Knife Talk podcast, but it's not like we're trying to schmooze somebody about to buy our knives. We probably know that 90% of the people listening are probably fellow knife makers. So, right. so that's kind of a comforting element of you opening up. So I suppose circling back around to answer your question about is this kind of death row meal vibes?
Let's go death row meal vibes.
Okay.
We'll go back and forth. You, your breakfast, my breakfast, your lunch, my lunch.
You're doing breakfast, lunch,
I'll
and dinner.
You.
Okay. Okay. You get the ball rolling.
Okay. There's no question in my mind. I don't think people understand the simplicity and the excellence of a bacon, egg, and cheese. And on a soft Kaiser roll, that the bacon, egg, and cheese is steamed, the inside of the Kaiser roll, and then there's a little bit of chew to it. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. My current favorite cheap bacon, egg, and cheese is from a gas station.
Yeah.
I got this one gas station where they have a little deli counter, and they pack this steam cabinet with bacon, egg, and cheeses, and for $4.50, you get a fucking banger. And I will say a bacon, egg, and cheese, salt and pepper.
It's got to steam for a while in the foil kind of wrapper.
It's got the foil kind of rehydrates the Kaiser roll.
Yeah.
The bagel doesn't work. The toast doesn't work. There's something about the Kaiser roll where it's kind of crusty and it's a little chewy and it's tender on the inside. Crispy bacon and then a slightly over easy egg and then salt and pepper. I don't do the ketchup.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Good call. I think for me, I suppose I'm I don't usually eat breakfast. I'm kind of a coffee get up going.
Me too.
I'm more of an 11s kind of guy, as the expression is here. So I suppose I'm very lucky that my dad kind of has a late breakfast because he's also up early, and that's usually when we get the day going. We kind of catch up and we meet. So if I join him for breakfast, there is a sort of an egg tomato situation that usually kicks off. And I think it's something nice. One of my childhood memories was a thing where my mum would kind of basically in water would start to poach an egg, and then a couple of small tomatoes would go into the same water. And then what would happen is that sort of cook the tomato. Then she'd literally get what looked like a whiskey glass, and you would kind of scoop out the egg that still had the runny yolk and the egg into there. A couple of the tomatoes would go in, a couple of grinds of coarsely ground pepper, good generous pinch of salt, and a fucking healthy knob of butter. And you would make this kind of like mess. It would just chugga, 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 chugga. And it would just basically in this glass. And that was my childhoody kind of like lovely kind of thing to eat with toast, because what it was mostly eggy, buttery, tomatoey kind of thing. So I'm always drawn to that. An egg cooked any fucking way you like, if there's a tomato involved and you know, a nice bit of smoked bacon, you know, because we have that. We have literally eggs in the yard, and there's a fucking bacon factory, you know. So
are you a pancake guy or no?
No, my kids are. I'm more the pampadou, you know, like the French toast would be my kids' kind of go to,
right.
and like they've, you know, sometimes we bounce into the sort of American pancakes where you actually beat the egg whites to get it fluffy and then fold that into your batter. I spoil the kids a bit doing good pancakes, but I think for me that's the breakfast is anything kind of egg based is a sort of a thing. So yeah,
okay.
That's breakfast.
Lunchtime.
Okay.
I go light for I don't eat really eat breakfast either.
Oh yeah.
But if I was going lunch, I'm going for like a death row meal lunch because I know that I'm going to kill it for dinner. Mm-hmm. I know that lunch is going to be nice and easy because dinner is going to be a destruction of I'm probably gonna get something light like a salad and like steak tartare.
Oh yeah. Dude,
I was in France, but you're eating out,
you're not knocking up steak tartare for yourself at home.
My dad used to make steak tartare.
You have to think ahead.
I'll never forget when we took our daughter to France. My dad used to make steak tartare and I loved it. And I remember we went to this place in France, and we ordered the steak tartare, and the guy knew we were American. He goes, "You know it's raw." I'm like, "Yeah, goddamn you!
Yeah.
Come on, man!
Give
me a break!" He's like, "Yeah, we have to say, you know, I'm American." So
yeah.
I would do like steak tartare with some toast points and a salad.
Yeah, I'm with you on
that's
that.
That's the bougiest shit I've ever said in my life.
No, bring on points. a little anchovy action as well.
Little anchovies, capers.
Oh fuck yeah, yeah.
Capers,
anything, yeah.
Little, you know, mustard, and some shallots.
Yeah. That's it. Totally, I'm with you in that. I would actually saddle up next to you and happily, you know, nose to the trough with that one anytime.
And French fries, steak tartare, and French fries. Oh my God, that is a match made in heaven.
Yeah, look, very very thin. I'm probably for that very thin, crispy kind of what are they called when they're thinner crisps? Chips.
You mean like shoestring?
There
potatoes.
You go. Yeah, I'd probably go down that road. You have to class it up. If you're going steak tartare, you have to class it up. You can't have that American chip shit. No McDonald's looking
Actually,
fucking things.
I had at my wedding. Charlie Palmer cooked at the wedding. We did trade, and I made, and he did a steak tartare on a gaufrette potato chip.
Mm-hmm.
A potato. It was unbelievable. It was the perfect bite. Potato chip, like a fried gaufrette potato. You know where that's the ridges, ridges of both sides you can see through, and then they cook crispy with a spoonful of steak tartare on the top.
Yeah.
Blew my doors off.
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
All right, what are you gonna have for lunch? You gonna sit next to me?
We're gonna do that.
Steak tartare for two on our last lunch on earth.
Absolutely, but you know what? One of the things, if it's summertime, and there's tomatoes are growing, a sourdough bread, the fucking like the proper job. Sourdough just out of the oven bread with an heirloom tomato, olive oil, and salt and pepper. Basta. That's it.
Pretty
just
good.
The ultimate tomato and the ultimate sourdough bread is above all probably my ratatouille moment.
That's you got it. You
Yeah. And then cheese is the thing. Do you know, there's I think we do eat a lot of cheese because we you know, we're cheesemongers as well. We have our cheese as well as everybody else's. So I suppose like that might have to play a role in this as well. Bring on some cheeses.
Okay.
Little baby
dinner
cheeses.
Dinner time. Dinner time. What are we doing for dinner? Now that this is it. Do you know what? Last meal.
Oh, do you know what? I think my happy moment of this year was I was down with Billy Durney in down in his place in down in Brooklyn. Oh, and
the Red Hook Tavern.
And everything he did was phenomenal, mind blowing. Meal of the year was with him, and he didn't hold back. Company was brilliant, the food was brilliant. But one of the courses that fucking blew my mind was the simplest, again, sometimes clean, simple, but brilliant, was the perfect bread. And it had some mortadella on top of that, and then he just made it rain with truffled pecorino on top.
Whoa.
So there was olive oil and all that kind of stuff in there as well. But basically it was microplaned sort of truffled pecorino, which you can get from Italy, which is none of that fake truffle bullshit. It was, which is rightly so getting a bit of a beating at the moment, you know, because, you know, fake truffle get very easily put into everything. But when you get the real McCoy. But mortadella is a childhood comfort food vibes, like maybe to many people the most synthetic processed food in the world, but actually comes from a very authentic, traditional, clean, honest place, and is a hard thing to make, and when was done well, was a big deal. So that was, he just did a tribute to that. And it was, because what happened was the truffle pecorino was so light. It's like that one where you have to be careful breathing in because it would sort of almost inhale it. It was like a cloud of, like a fluffy kind of thing of this on top of it. That was the best bite. So that's a starter for, that's my favorite starter for dinner.
Okay.
And then I hate to say it, but I think we're just going to have to go for a really good, if I'm cooking at home, I mean, like I said, I want my death row meal to be cooked by my sister, you know. She's the best. I mean, I suppose she's taken my mum's skill, and but we grew up together, so we've also been perverted by the world in the same way, so we have similar taste buds, but she's by far the better foodie than me, so she can just do anything. And now she's also trained, she's a trained chef, so I would cook anything. But if I was just myself and the whole thing, I think I'm in the mood for just a really good steak, you know, like I think just done fucking well. I mean, there's a thousand ways to eat it, but in the end there's we have we're not talking like Wagyu, Japanese Wagyu, we're talking Irish Wagyu, because you have Wagyus all around the world now. It's leaner, it's not like the fatty kind of like type Wagyu. This is actually very lean Irish grass-fed Wagyu, but it has a mouthfeel that's unique. It's because it's got the sort of, you don't have to chew, you know, it's got flavor because it's grass-fed, so it's not as sort of like the USDA or that kind of side of things. But a good feather blade, a bavette, skirt steak, any of those. We're not talking about fillet or sirloin. I want to go for
tougher
one of the
cut.
Do you know that the cuts with flavor, but the breed is making up for everything, so it's going to be a tender, you know. So, you know, that's my kind of mood. Get the perfectly aged, room temperature, cooked to perfection, take off its horn, slap its ass, and send it in. You know, we're not talking about a slow braise. We're talking about, you know, wipe its ass and send it in. You know, like, well, what was
please,
the way you did?
To
take off its horns, wipe its ass, and let me eat my way out.
Please wipe its ass.
Yeah, exactly.
I tell you what, those tougher cuts are for some. They're so much better in the
I think it's a wrong word to say tougher cut. I think probably I know what you mean, but I suppose the thing is, it's probably just the lesser cut or the lesser prime cut. These are more like, I suppose
I'm not trying to be disrespectful.
No, I hear you.
I'm just,
you're right.
Well, here's the problem. I think the American palate for beef is perverted to a certain degree, and I think that the American palate is,
well, you guys don't like to chew.
Right, exactly. And the other thing is the American palate for, I'll just talk about beef. Our butchering system is different than the European butchering system. That's why you'll see different cuts. Like people say, what's a bavette? There's different cuts than they do in the United States. And in the United States,
a lot of them different
prefer
names, but yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, it's approached from a slightly different angle, but much of it is intertwined.
And there's a different mindset in terms of the way steaks are cooked. It's like, you know, the filet mignon. I went to the supermarket yesterday to pick up some things, and a guy bought a – I sent a message to Craig because Craig was talking about this big beef he was going to cook for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at the guy next to me, and he ordered this – and this is a supermarket. This isn't like a specialty butcher shop. He got a prime rib, which is like – it was probably like
– Yeah, another one.
I would say 15 pounds, 12, 15 pounds. It's
big. Yeah.
And I looked at the price tag. $375.
Yeah.
And I thought, Jesus H. Christ.
Yeah.
I'm like, that is crazy. But the thing is, people want a ribeye. People want a softer to cut. They want the goddamn filet mignon. They want the filet. And it's like they want it to be tasteless and soft. And it's shocking to me, Mike.
Well, I love it. Let those fucking eejits keep buying the overpriced shit cuts and then leave us our tasty ones and that we know how to cook.
The problem is in the United States now compared to the 80s. In the 80s, the cheaper cuts were cheaper cuts. Now the cheaper cuts are now the expensive cuts.
Oh, yeah. You're getting obsessed about your oxtail.
Well, they are. I don't fuck with the oxtail. I've never had oxtail.
You don't have
before.
The time to stand over the stove for 6 hours like I do. Yeah.
I have never had oxtail before. And in part of my mind,
you were going on about it for ages, but I suppose you were right.
Oh,
because
it's the closest part to the asshole. the bigger the chunk of oxtail, the closer it is to the asshole. It's the asshole flap. And part of me is just like, I can never get past that. You know, the bigger the oxtail, the closer the asshole. And I'm like, you know what? I'm good. Yeah. I'm good. But I would say for me, and if my guy Tomer Botner is listening to this, my brother, he takes me every year we go see this chef. Yeah. His name is Borja. Yeah. And he has this restaurant called Ultramarinos Marine. And I've been eating meals from the chef Borja for 6-7 years. Yeah. And I nearly
want to fly in to actually meet you guys just for that lunch.
Dude, this is the guy.
Next time.
Is the guy that when like Jose Andreas shows up to Barcelona, he goes to see Borja.
That man's a legend.
When like the real guys go, they go see Borja.
Yep.
Borja makes his own, it's called, what's that? It's a fish sauce. It's called Roman style fish sauce.
The reduced. Exactly. Another one.
I forgot the name of it. Yeah. I forgot the name of it. It's this crazy Roman style fish sauce with fermented, and he makes it himself. Mm-hmm. He makes everything. And it's like, there's not a vegetable to be had. it's like the freshest seafood you've ever seen. Mm-hmm. The beef is aged. He ages it himself. Everything's cooked on a flat top.
Yeah.
With
plancha.
The stoves are all wood stoves inside this place. Mm-hmm. It looks like a torture chamber. And it's what's that goddamn stuff called? It's unbelievable. Yeah. And every year we go and we hug Borja and I bring him something and he makes us this dinner. That's just the best, the best thing we ever had. And then I got to take my wife and daughter there. And my daughter, who loves food stuff, she says it was the best meal she ever had in her
life.
So we would, garum, you're the man, garum. And you can get garum. Garum is amazing. Uh-huh. And it's intense. It's not like a Vietnamese fish sauce, but if you throw garum in, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it at specialty stores. Uh-huh. And if you put it in with a little bit of lemon juice and olive oil,
it's liquid umami.
Like dynamite.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's dynamite. And he'll cook the shrimp and then he'll put the garum on. And then he'll cook the this and he'll put the garum on. And everything is like incredibly fresh, plenty of salt, and not a lot of seasonings. And he made this one potato for us that it was the best potato I ever had in my life. It was like a roasted potato.
Yeah.
It was a fried roasted potato. And I said, I don't understand how you made this potato so good. And he said, he says, the devil's in the details, and I'll tell you what I do. I buy fresh potatoes. I don't fuck around with, and he's not talking the way I'm talking. He's talking with, you know, a Spanish accent. He buys these fresh potatoes, and maybe you know more about it. I didn't know you could get fresh potatoes. But there's something about these special varieties of fresh potatoes, and if you treat them in a certain manner, they blow the doors off of the potatoes that you're used to.
Hmm. Well, I mean, like you have your waxy and your flowery and you have so many different variations. But yeah, that there is Yeah, getting your hands on the right one. Yeah, no, it's fun. And every culture kind of has their own little take on it and stuff. But yeah, no, the potato goes back so far and so long, and there's so many different varieties, and there's such a history to it. But it's all about, you know, good fat. You know, I mean, that's it. It's your olive oil or your whatever else. Like, that's, I mean, the backbone of Christmas dinner is quite honestly, the like, never mind your turkey or your ham. It's the fucking roast potatoes is
cooked, I think, in the fat, right?
Oh, yeah, shit, yeah, yeah.
Jesus Christ, look at us.
Okay, dessert. Got to send it up properly.
All right. I, you know what? I bucked the system, and my wife knows this, and it kind of bothers her. I'm not a giant chocolate person. Like, I like chocolate, but I'm not freaking out.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you. I can eat chocolate on its own, but I'm not into brownies or chocolate dessert.
Chocolate cakes and all that shit. It's
fine. Give me a bar of chocolate. Like, good 70-cent chocolate, but I don't want it for dessert. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm with you.
I think bananas are an underrated dessert flavor. Underrated. I love the flavor of banana ice cream or banana cake and stuff like that.
I want to eat the banana that went extinct.
Oh yeah, me too. I see these videos.
Because that's
of these
what the fake banana flavor is based on—the one that doesn't exist anymore. Isn't that it?
Well, the banana flavor, the way the French handle the flavor of banana is dynamite. I that kind of like I'm falling into the caramel, caramel end, or the vanilla caramel end, or banana coconut situation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That would be my move. I think that if you hit me with something like that, something in that range,
Have you ever barbecued a banana in its skin and it kind of goes black, and then you do the whole things with, you know, like, I remember we used to do things with Bailey's. You kind of cook it in its skin and it goes black and it kind of cooks and poaches. Then you pop it out and you can eat it with ice cream, a little splash of Bailey's on top of that.
My dad used to make me bananas flambé.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
If I was good, if I was really
good. On the rare occasion.
Dude, you know what, though? This is the one thing I hated. I had to beg him for bananas flambé. And it was just like,
what was he flambéing with?
He would tease me. He would take, put some
little cognac
butter in the pan,
kind of vibe.
Butter in the pan with sugar, and then he would make it to a caramel, and then he'd use rum.
Okay.
He'd put a little rum in. Flambé it in, drop the bananas in. Or no, you drop the bananas in before you flambé it.
Yeah.
So you butter and sugar, caramel, bananas in, and then drop in some rum, and then you shoot, and then you
some
flambé
fireworks.
The whole thing out.
Yeah, yeah.
And Jesus Christ, and then I used to have to beg him. I said, Dad, I've been so good. My grades are good. I'm begging you for bananas flambé. And he goes, you haven't been that good. Yeah, was really such a fucking rarity. And I remember when he would, and then you eat it over ice cream. And I remember the times I had bananas flambé, I thought, this is the greatest goddamn thing I'd ever seen, ever eaten in a home.
Yeah, yeah.
So, something like that.
Oh, fantastic. I think that's good. My mom makes a thing called clefoutis, which is fantastic with cherries and stuff like that. It's kind of one of those upsy downy
like
flip over kind of
almost.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sort of it's one of those things that's quite simple, but there's a skill. I'd say, like, if you ever wanted to get a job in a restaurant, you know, and he asked you to just kind of, you know, cook that, it would be like a test. You think it's easy, but it's not. But the name is part of the magic, I think, for me.
Well, you got Christmas on the way, New Year's on the way. What are you looking forward to for 2026, Finkel Ferguson?
Do you know what? I think, I think I'm looking forward to doing some forging. I've got a lot of the toys. There's now the third workshop is up and running. We have the, there's power hammer, 70 ton press. So I've got a 50 kilo, power hammer, Kuna Reiter power hammer. There's the 70 ton press, and I've now got a Tobin rolling mill. So I kind of have a lot of the toys that really make everything kind of possible now. So I really want to kind of go down and sort of go down the Mareko rabbit hole, play with a bit of mosaic, you know, make a bit of twist Damascus, you know, sort of those kind of side of things is something I'm very much enjoying, making laminates and doing all that kind of side of things and sort of making the steels. It's interesting, for a lifetime of actually making stainless steel knives, I realized that the efficiency of stainless steel knives is a certain type of market. But I've kind of realized that I want to actually sort of, yeah, I'm knife making in reverse, aren't I? I think, you know, and I'm enjoying that. And I think the thing is, I want to bring people with me, because I probably have now got a number of clientele in some kind of ways who bought my stainless steel knives and probably would never have owned a carbon steel knife, and I probably want them to maybe go down that, you know, adventure and journey with me, because there is definitely stainless steels out there that are now probably superior in so many ways to the vast majority of carbon steels, but there are still carbon steels that can do things the stainless can't. But it's the romantic love and the beauty of having a knife that you actually have to take care of, nurture, look after, oil. And if anything, it'll pay you back with patina and sort of a bond, you know. And I think that that's something I'm kind of very much enjoying, the creative process and the metallurgy and alchemy and the whole, you know, thing of it. But it's the, I'm actually enjoying the sparks. I'm enjoying, do you know what it is? It's the challenge. It's the, you know, forging knives to shape, you know, it's. There's a fucking easy way of doing it. You can make a laminate, flatten it out, cut out the shape, but actually having really thick, chunky tangs and, you know, tapering it out beautifully, you know, and that kind of side of things. If you're a knife maker, you know what happened, you know. And I was at the market the other day, and I had some of my knives, some of the high carbon steel knives there, and you know, there's people who will be shocked that a knife costs, you know, several hundred euros. And you're kind of like, you know, and that's not the client for you, but it is kind of when they are friends and you kind of can talk to them about it. And you know, it is something that when you go down that rabbit hole, and I'm in that rabbit hole, I want to forge. I want to be the student. I want to make mistakes. I want to learn. And then I think that the whole Fingal Ferguson knives ship will rise as a result of that element of probably exploration down that kind of road and actually being more hands-on, you know. So I think I will probably have less time as the years go on in the workshop, and I want that to probably be based around forging. And then I will have periods of being trying to be productive and make stainless knives and doing things like that, but I think the time I will get excited will be the forging of a blade. Yeah,
look at you, Fingal Ferguson, man. I love you, dude.
I love you too, buddy.
And I hope that you and your family have a wonderful Christmas,
yep,
a peaceful and prosperous new year. Mm-hmm. And here's to 2026, 2025, ups and downs,
mm-hmm,
no question, but
yep,
that's life. And onward and upward, peace and prosperity to you, my bro.
Belly rubs and hugs and kisses, exactly.
You too, my bro. Guys, I wish you all a wonderful end of the year, and I wish for a peaceful, prosperous new year for all of you. Many thanks for all the kind support all over the years, especially now. Many thanks to the sponsors who have been so generous with me and this show and you, the listener. And I'm looking forward to a little bit of a break, and we will be back in 2026 with the one and only Jesse Uweta, as always.
Hey.
So guys, have a healthy, happy new year. Fingal, I love you, my man.
Love you too,
send
buddy.
And
I love you
family.
All. Thank you to everybody. We've got beautiful people in our world. So this is a brilliant community to be part of. And thanks to everybody who listens to these.
I'm with you. All right, guys. Happy New Year.
Mwah.
Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.